Bismillahi r-Rahmani r-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa usalli wa usallam ala Sayyid al-Awwalin wal-Akhirin. Nabiyyina Muhammadin wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa barak wa sallam. All praise are due to Allah, Lord of the worlds, and peace and blessings be constantly showered upon our beloved Prophet Muhammad, the master of the first and the last, and his family, his companions, and all those who call to his way and establish his sunnah to the day of judgment. My beloved brothers and sisters, to our viewers, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Alhamdulillah, this is another opportunity for us to reflect upon some very important information regarding Islam and Muslims. And we are looking at minarets and thrones and the relationship between scholars and rulers. And in this light, today was a strange day for me and for many people, because the United Nations General Assembly was meeting in New York City. And there were leaders from all over the world who were there expressing themselves. And I happened to be able to listen to the talk that was delivered by the President of Turkey, President Erdogan. And it was a powerful speech. And as the leader of Turkey, which was once one of the most powerful countries on earth, he made some very clear points. And I reflect on Turkey because I've been in Istanbul a number of times, and every time I go there, and you look at the size of the buildings, and you look at the city, and you have to say to yourself, I mean, these people had power, especially if you go back to the 16th century, you can see the level of power that they had compared to the rest of the world. And even today, his country is very strategic. It was probably the only country that could get the Russians and the Ukrainians to sit at the peace table. So he's a very important person. And he spoke very clear, very straightforward. One of the points that he made very clearly is that the United Nations representatives have been meeting over the past year and witnessing the genocide that is happening in Palestine. And now the bombs are falling in Lebanon as we speak. This is how he was addressing them. The bombs are falling. And it is a test for the United Nations. Because if the United Nations, if these are the countries of the world, this is a group that was set up in order never to have another Nazi, German type of Holocaust of people, or the misuse of technology, the destruction of nations. That's the reason why this is set up, to stop genocide. So if we cannot do this, then we are under a serious test, and this United Nations could become actually unworkable. And he mentioned that there's a clause within their rulings or the amendments of the United Nations that if all attempts fail to stop any aggression, then they have the right for coercion, which means force. They have the right to send in force. And that is the reality. If a nation becomes a rogue state and thousands of people are dying, this could have consequence for the whole globe. Somebody has to stop them. And so he said, I want to be part of allied nations the same way the allies stopped Hitler. He said, I want to be part of a group of allies who will stop the aggression, the things that are happening now, because this is not only going to influence the Middle East, but this will have ramifications all over the world. And he even said that the battles are going on, the world is reached a very low place. And he said even the Paris Olympics was a war against the sacred, because in the beginning of the Paris Olympics, they had pornographic types of presentations. They insulted Jesus, Isa alayhi salam. They insulted Catholicism, Christianity. And he said, all people who believe in God are insulted by this. And so it's a very crucial point. But the question that came in my mind, and again, this is one of the reasons why we are taking this course, is that even though Turkey is a mighty nation, it is the second most powerful nation in NATO, it is one of the most powerful in the Middle East itself. Okay, even though there are great Chechen warriors and Dagestanis, and Pakistan has 170 nuclear weapons in Pakistan. Afghan soldiers are still there. Okay, and there are other major forces. Then how can people be stagnated to the point where they're forced to watch innocent children being bombed and being killed? Something is seriously wrong. Something is wrong. And this is what Muslims need to understand. If not this generation right now, then the next generation needs to understand which direction to go and to pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for some real change to come about in our nation in order to be able to come out of the situation that we are in. So the powerful representative of the Turkish nation, representing the potential of the Muslim world that we discussed, over 26% of the world's population, all types of natural resources, strategic position. Turkey is right at the point, the straits there connect Europe with Asia, the Black Sea. It is crucial. Yemen, Djibouti, Somalia at the bottom of the Red Sea. And you see what Houthis are doing now in terms of international trade. Malaysia is on the Malacca Straits. And those straits that are going down through Malaysia and Southeast Asia, you know, much of the world's traffic, economic traffic, is going through, you know, that area itself. So strategic positions. There's hundreds of these positions Muslims have. And we have the armies to protect it or to disrupt other people. We have young people. We have a future. Intellectuals. And we have money. Some of the richest people on earth are Muslims. Okay, so many things as we looked at. Our history and our religion is still growing. But with all this, there are some serious contradictions that are happening. And this is the frustration that I felt and that many people are feeling right now, is that with this great wealth, there is poverty. And with the huge armies, there is defeat. There is humiliation. Intellectuals, many of the debates are over trivial matters, over minor things. And if the younger generation, those who are online, you'll see many so-called Muslim sites, they're fighting over really small issues. Even the issue of the Molid, for instance. Do you celebrate the birthday of the Prophet or do you not celebrate the birthday? And people go to the point where they will declare somebody is like out of the faith if they celebrate it, and other ones will declare if they don't celebrate it. The reality is that we know that it was not celebrated by the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, not by his companions, not until almost 1,000 years after his death. And it started in Fatimid Egypt, who was a Shia dynasty in Egypt. But still, if somebody wanted to remember the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, his seerah, his life, to give sadaqah, technically speaking, there's nothing wrong with that. It's only when you declare it's an Eid, when you declare it's a must to be a Muslim, you put it on the level of Eid al-Fitr and Eid al-Adha. When you do that, now you've entered bid'ah. But if Muslims are taking advantage of this time, because he was born in Rabi' al-Awwal, nobody knows the exact date. They say the 12th seems to be the strongest, but it's not the only date. If somebody wants to do that, leave them alone. Because we have greater issues to deal with, especially when our families are being bombed and killed. and droughts are happening, and so many things are happening in the Muslim world. So it creates a type of frustration that is there, and we need change. And we found out that Allah said very clearly, "Inna Allah la yughayyiru ma biqawmin hatta yughayyiru ma bi anfusihim." Allah will not change the condition of a people till they change that which is in themselves. So it's something in our hearts, something in the body of Islam that has to change. It's like a giant that can do so many things, but the giant is sick. The giant's been sleeping, and now it's waking up. And when you first wake up, you feel really groggy, like you're not sure of things. That's how the Muslim world is now. It's like a giant that's just woken up from a deep sleep. And so, in looking at the traditions of the Prophet ﷺ and the different aspects of Islam, we recognize that the Prophet, peace be upon him, said, "There is something that I fear for my ummah more than Dajjal." Okay? And that's serious. More than the Antichrist. And he repeated it three times. And when he was asked about what it was, he said, "Misguided and astray leaders." If your leaders are misguided, and this hadith comes in different forms. One time it said, "Al-a'immat al-dalun," right? So those are lost leaders. And there's another one that says, "Al-a'immat al-mudillin." So mudillin are people who are not just lost, they'll take you astray. Okay, so leaderships. He identified the leaders, and we looked at the writings of one of the great scholars of Islam, Sidi Ahmed Zarruq, rahimahullah, from Fez in North Africa. And in looking at sincerity in the famous hadith of the Prophet ﷺ, that is, you know, religion is ad-dinu nasiha, that religion is sincerity. And they said, "For who?" And he said, "For Allah, His Messenger, His Book, the general body of Muslims, and the leaders." Okay, so now he broke down the concept of leaders. And he said, the leaders is the umara, okay, and the ulama and the fuqara. Now, the terms you're going to see for leaders, there's interchangeable terms. There's amir, who is the one who has the command. There is imam, who's the one who is leading, in a sense. It's usually prayer, but imam at different points means different things. Because even the Prophet ﷺ in the hadith, he said a'imma, he said imams, misguided imams. Okay, so leadership can take, the names are interchangeable. So the ulama and the fuqara. And the fuqara, he meant those people who claim to be spiritual leaders. Today they would say the tasawwuf, the Sufi leaders, or those who are claim spirituality. So there are some who are dealing with book knowledge, who are dealing with the revelation and your rules. There are others who are dealing with ihsan, with the heart. Okay, so it's two forms in a sense. We recognized that in early Islam, there was no separation between the two. So having knowledge of the book, having knowledge of the Quran and the Sunnah, would give you knowledge of the heart. It gives you spirituality. It should not really be separated. And that's originally how it was. But as time went by and there were so many millions of Muslims and people accepting Islam who had different cultures, specializations start coming, where people specialize in different things. So this is where, by his time, Ahmed Zarruq, 600 years or so ago, there were the ulama, who are your scholars of your book knowledge, the Quran, the Sunnah, fiqh, and there was the fuqara, or there was the spiritual people who are dealing with ihsan, right? How to have spirituality and righteousness. He had an answer for all of them. And it's something to reflect upon, because he's talking about sincerity, right? This is the masses of the people. This is us. He said the umara. So that's the political leader, is the one who has the gun or the sword, sultan, that the Turks would call. So who is your sultan? Who's your leader? Today it's your president, your prime minister, you know, whatever, who has the military under them. That's the umara. So he said, you give them obedience. You should obey the leaders. But he made a condition. Because you'll have some scholars today that will even say, obey your leaders, anything they do. And that has to be put in the right context. Because the right context is, you obey your leaders as long as they obey Allah. So if they don't obey Allah, then you don't have to obey them. Okay? Then he said the ulama, that you should acknowledge them, acknowledge because they are spending their life studying. You should acknowledge them as long as they have dalil, proofs. They have to have proofs. They can't tell you, well, I'll answer your question. I had a dream last night. You had a dream. No, I want something more than a dream. I want something from the revelation. And you're supposed to be trained to give me that, you see? And the fuqara, if a person claims to be a knowledgeable person, right, he's a scholar, but and he deals with the heart and the higher level of spiritual Islam, as long as he stays within Sharia. So if he stays within Islamic law, listen to them, especially if they're scholars. They go outside of Islamic law and start telling you to do things that Hindus do, or Buddhists do, or Christians do, don't follow them. Okay? Do not submit yourself to them. So the point is here, you could divide this into two sections. One section is the people with the gun, the rulers, political leaders. And the other side are people with knowledge and spirituality. And that's the essence of our course, which we say minarets and thrones. Okay, so that's the essence of it. And a relationship between these two groups, which is critical. Because really, in the case of President Erdogan of Turkey, who was there in the United Nations General Assembly, saying very strong things, but unfortunately, he has said things before that are strong, and I don't take anything from him because it was bold what he did. But why is it that he can't completely follow this up? Okay, why are there contradictions? Okay, what is it to complete the picture? What did Ottomans have at certain point? Why they could establish justice in the world? Why at different points in the world Muslims established justice? Okay, that's relationship. Part of the problem is the relationship between the rulers and scholars. And we're going to find out how serious this is. What is a scholar? Okay, so we're using the word ulama, which is a plural of alim. Alim from ilm. That is a term that can also be used in a lot of different ways. Because if you just say scholar, you could be a scholar of IT. You could be a scholar of math. You could be a scholar of science. And sometimes the scholarship is so many different areas that you can see in a university. Okay? Here, we're talking about an Islamic scholar, right? And because this has great respect from amongst that the Muslims have, right? And these scholars are actually literally inheritors of the prophets. Okay, so this is how serious this scholarship is. And the basic job of the scholars is transmitting and interpreting and applying Islamic knowledge. See the three things. To transmit it, you got to interpret it, what it actually is, and then apply it. Okay, you got to do all three. And this is a big task. This is something which is really serious because the essence of an Islamic society, what distinguishes an Islamic society from a secular society, is the fact that the basis is revelation. The basis is not a constitution made by human beings. It's not so-called democracy. It's not Marxism. The basis is the revelation. And so the alim is the one who literally is interpreting this knowledge to be implemented in a society. That's a serious thing. To the point where in Surah Az-Zumar, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala told us, قُلْ هَلْ يَسْتَوِ الَّذِينَ يَعْلَمُونَ وَالَّذِينَ لَا يَعْلَمُونَ إِنَّمَا يَتَذَكَّرُ أُولُو الْأَلْبَابِ. Allah told us, say, O Muhammad, are those who know equal to those who do not know? Only they will remember who are people of understanding. And this ilm here is talking about revelation. Okay? This can be applied to a lot of things in a sense, but the overwhelming thing we're talking about here now is the revelation. And the Prophet ﷺ even said, and there's a few different versions of this hadith, he said the scholars, right, al-ulama, warathat al-anbiya. So he said the scholars are inheritors of the prophets. And in another hadith, he said, al-ulama khulafa al-anbiya. He said they are the khalifas, they are the successors of the prophets, is the scholars. That's a big thing, because everybody wants a khalifa now, right? You want somebody to rule the Muslim world. This is saying that the scholars are the successors and inheritors of the prophet. They do not leave behind dinars and dirhams, meaning they don't leave gold and silver, but they only leave knowledge. That they didn't leave money. Okay, so this ulama, it's a very serious position. And if this ulama position is right, if it is right, and if it is leading as the khalifa, remember khulafa, then you would have Islam instituted from the top down. And when the leader who's controlling the military, who's controlling the finance, right, is now dealing with revelation, respecting revelation, okay, now you have a powerful Islamic society. And this is what happened with the Ottoman Turks. We saw it before, of course, in the first generations, but I'm using them as an example because we're even looking at the Turks now in New York City. But that's when they had this authority. Okay? So, the Khalifa, the leader, the Emir, on top, and this is our concept now, the Emir on top, he might not be a scholar. He's just the person with the gun or the sword. But he has scholars who can correct him. He has scholars who he listens to. And so therefore, together, they make up the leadership. So now you have a solid leadership. Okay, so once that happens, then you have a powerful society. And the Ottomans used to say, when, because I've studied them in some detail, and when they were the most powerful, they had three elements. They had another element, which is another, it was an important one as well, but they had three elements. One is that they had what they call the Alps. The Alps would be the soldiers, the military, the fighters, okay? And then they had the scholars. And then they had the business people. So you combine the three, right? And that's going to be important today because not only do we need a military, you got to have an economy. So if you have those, you know, your fighters who will defend you, right? But they are connected to scholars or led by scholars. And you have an economy underneath it. Now we're talking the solution, a reality that can still happen to Muslims. But the danger is if the scholars are not here, or if the scholars go astray, remember what the Prophet ﷺ said. He said he fears these leaders, if these leadership people are going astray. They're not doing what's right. Okay? It's worse. He fears it even more than Dajjal. And that's serious. That's something which is really serious. And Abdullah ibn Amr ibn al-As radiallahu anhuma reported that the Prophet ﷺ said, he said, "Verily Allah does not take away knowledge by snatching it from people. But he takes away knowledge by taking away the scholars. So that when he leaves no learned person, people turn to ignorant as their leaders. Then they ask to deliver religious verdicts, and they deliver them without knowledge, and they go astray, and they lead others astray." This is what happens when the leaders are the johal, which is ignorant, the jahil. When they are the ones in leadership, then it's a serious situation. Or if the leaders become those who will take you astray, dalun, if the leaders are actually submitting to evil or doing evil, now Islamic society, you can have all the khutbahs, all the salats, all everything you want. But we're not going to get success. And we have to study this. We have to understand what it is. Okay, but in order to understand what it is, we need to understand what actually is Islamic scholarship. This is a deep subject, which could take the whole semester, just to discuss what is Islamic scholarship. And people tend to, look at it in a very, simple way. Like the person who's going to go to Maulana or the Sheikh, in one of the Muslim countries, I don't want to say which one it is, but they used to say if they had a son and they said, "This son, if he's really intelligent, then send him to medical, let him be a doctor." This happened in a lot of Muslim countries, 20th century. "If he can't be a doctor, then let him be an engineer. If he can't be an engineer, then let him be an accountant." And this literally happened in one country. I'll say it. It was Syria. They actually took your test scores, and the ones on the top, they put them in med school, whether you like blood or not. The next ones, you become engineer, you become accountant, or you become a lawyer, right? Then they said, in this one Muslim country, if he's a bad little boy, a spoiled brat, then put him in the Quran school. Let him be a Maulana. That's what they were doing. So the little boy who was causing trouble, right? Send him to the madrasa. So the madrasa teacher can beat him into place. So he gets beat to learn the Quran. So what happened then? When people suddenly realized that Islam is the solution, and then these Maulanas or these so-called sheikhs were graduating, bad little boys who now had a cap on, so now you're in trouble now because you have the worst of your people who are actually in the leadership position, you see? So when Islam was in its height, the young males, young females, those who had potential would study Islam. And I'm saying females as well because there were many female scholars. They would study Islam, the best of the people, cream of the crop. Okay? And then it would go down. So what was it? What was it that takes somebody who has the highest level of intelligence to deal with? And why would this be so important? Number one, again, we have to understand we're dealing with ilm. We're dealing with the knowledge of the revelations. So this is how you're going to govern your society. This is how decisions are going to be made, economic, political, social, not just religious. Your whole life within a society has to go back to this, along with your engineering and your medicine and architecture. Of course, these are all important subjects. Okay, but the base subject is this. So a scholar, if somebody is an alim, because there are many people who claim to be alims, but they're not. And there's a lot of different terms, and it's not their fault. There's different levels of it. And in different countries, some people are forced to take leadership because there's nobody else. But they should be able to say, when they don't know, I don't know. The problem is when the person is not qualified and then he says, I know, that's where your problem comes in. Right? That's a immatal mudallin. They take you astray. So the scholar, number one, needs to have a deep understanding of Arabic language. You cannot be a scholar in Islam on the highest level if you do not have a deep understanding of Arabic. And Arabic does not have to be your first language, by the way. Because if you look at many of the great ulama, look at hadith. And you'll see Bukhari and Muslim and Tirmidhi and Nisa'i, you know, go the great muhaddithin, the majority were non-Arabs. Persian speaking, Turkish language speaking, other languages. They were not Arabs, but Arabic became their second language. They mastered the Arabic. And that requires not just learning how to talk like Babel. You take the course Babel and you can talk in the marketplace and you can buy apples and oranges. You have to understand Arabic language. And Arabic is one of the deepest languages on earth. I would say Arabic, compared to other languages, it's in another league altogether. And I found this out, you know, coming from America, and we speak English, and those of us who are English-speaking only, we have a very narrow understanding. If you go to the third world, different Asia, Africa, people speak 3, 4, 5 languages. If you only speak English, you've got a problem, because you're a very narrow thing. If you say, he jumped, she jumped, they jumped, it jumped, you use the same form, but in Arabic, there's male jumped, female jumped, inanimate object jumped, it changed, the verb changes. There's a group of females, verb changes. Group of males, verb changes. So you have to know all of those different forms. Even like if you're studying French, right? French is deeper than English. And those who understand French, the French use different, descriptions in male and female and different things. It's a higher level. Arabic is deep. Arabic has got something that most languages don't have. And that is, it has dual. Two. So if two people are doing something, they walked. Those two walked. You have to have another verb for that. It's the verb for two. Think about this. How deep your language has got to be. And that's why the poetry in Arabic is so deep. Because they can go all over the place. And they can use, there's so much usages. So in order to master Arabic, then you have to get familiar with it, speaking, writing, reading. And then you got to know the grammar. You have to know something about the logic of Arabic, and also the balagha, that is the word usage and the poetic things that come. You got to study Arabic poetry, right? You got to know all the nuances within the language, because sometimes these nuances come within the reading of the Quran itself. And you have to know how Arabic has changed. Like in Surah to Yusuf, when it's talking about the caravan came, when Yusuf, Nabi Yusuf alayhi salam, was thrown in the well, and the caravan came. And the Quran is saying, Wajad Sayyara, that the Sayyara came. It's the caravan, right? But today, Sayyara means a car, like Toyota. You speak in Arabic today, you say, what kind of Toyota Sayyara do you have? Oh, I have a Mercedes. That's what Sayyara. So you look at the Quran, you see Sayyara, and you think it means a Toyota? No. So you have to know the changes Arabic went through. So that takes time to master it. Okay? That's a subject that you'll do there. When I studied in Medina, and I don't consider myself to be a scholar, we just have some taste of knowledge. But just to get a taste of the knowledge, to enter into the area where you could possibly be a scholar, in the first year of the university, I had 13 subjects. 13 subjects. Okay? That included Arabic and included, and you're going to see some of the subjects. You're studying side by side, and when the final exams come, you have 13 exams. Okay? And in the first year, in the College of Dawah and Usul al-Din, you have to memorize 2.5 sections of the Quran. You have to memorize. And you're going to get tested on it. Okay? That's just for the first year. And in some universities, like Azhar University, in order to enter into the Arabic Azhar University, the high part, you have to memorize the Quran before you even get in. If you didn't memorize the Quran, you cannot even enter. So this is serious business here, right? This is like nuclear physicists as opposed to a pharmacist in Shoppers Drug Mart. This is a nuclear physicist. That's the level it can go to, right? So the scholar then, needs to have the basic core subjects. And again, this is a deep area, and I just want to give you a general understanding of it before we go into the practical application of what happened to scholarship and scholars. Number one, with the language, you got to study Quranic sciences, because that's the revelation, Ulum al-Quran. Alhamdulillah, we have a Sheikh, Sheikh Abdul Hamid, is teaching a course on Ulum al-Quran. Right, so you have to have this basic things. Okay, and within that, and there's a number of things, but within it is tafsir, which is exegesis, or it is interpretation, understanding what the Quran actually means. And that means that you need to understand the context. Why were the verses revealed? Asbab al-Nuzul, the nuances, the changes that it went through. Okay, you got to go to the commentaries. There were great scholars who made commentaries. Okay, and you have to be able to apply this now. If you're on a high level, you have to be able to apply that to today's situation. That's the highest level. Okay? And in the Quranic thing, there is the qira'ah, there's recitations. You know it's tajweed, but you have to master different forms of the recitations. Okay? So that's just your basic study there. Now, another area that the scholar needs to be involved in is hadith sciences. So you have to know, this is now the revelation coming through the Prophet ﷺ, وَمَا يَنْتِقُ عَنِ الْهَوَىٰ إِنْ هُوَ إِلَّا وَحْيٌ يُوحَىٰ. As Allah said, he doesn't speak from himself. He is a revelation that is coming out. It's coming through him. So you have to have a comprehensive understanding of hadith. Okay, so you have to understand what is authentic and what is not authentic. Okay, and that is what is called sahih, hasan, da'if. These are all subjects to take, right? Then you have to know the isnad. So when you say a hadith, like I just read Abdullah ibn Amr ibn al-As, right? That Abdullah, he gave the hadith. But there are names before that. So the scholar actually has to know these names and understand it. There is a scholar today that I can say is clearly a scholar. His name is Sheikh Muhammad al-Hassan, Wuld al-Hassan al-Didu. He's from Mauritania. He's a Shankiti scholar. And Sheikh Muhammad al-Hassan, when he gives a hadith, he will tell you on the authority of this one, that one, that one, that one, that one. He'll list about 12 people that it came from the Prophet. He's all in his head. He's not reading it out of a book. Okay? So you have to understand what is called isnad. Okay, and that is the chain of the narrators, to know what is reliable and what is not reliable. This is a science in itself. It's a science. And you'll see that Bukhari and Muslim, and these people, they were very strict in whether they would accept somebody's hadith. And they would actually test people to see, is this person a reliable person or not? In one case, Bukhari was looking for a person and he came in the area and that person was there, and then he wanted to get his animals, his sheep, And he took an empty bucket and he put it there and he said to the animals, ta'al, ta'al, ta'al. He called them and the animals came running to get, and there was nothing in the bucket. And Bukhari's watching him. So he said, if he will lie to the animals, he will lie on the Prophet. You see how strict he is? If it's in his nature to lie, if you would lie to your animals, that means there's something wrong with your personality. You see, I'm not going to go to this person because he's probably a liar. That's how strict they were. Okay, so that study, you know, there's Usul al-Hadith, which is the Hadith methodology. You know, how do you authenticate the people on the chain? And deep subject. Okay, all of these things are needed in order to understand Hadith. People throw around Hadiths today. They just read it in a book and then they throw it around. But the person who's a scholar, right, has to know the chain and what is called the metin, the body of the hadith, because sometimes the person will say something in the metin, in the body, and it doesn't make sense. It is not classical Arabic. And the Prophet ﷺ spoke in classical Arabic, so they can detect whether it's a lie or not. Okay. Then also Islamic jurisprudence, that's fiqh, which we hear about. We hear about the fiqh, the madhabs. So if you're going to be a scholar, you got to know, for instance, Shafi'i fiqh, Maliki fiqh, Hanbali, Hanafi. So some scholars will be a scholar of Hanafi fiqh. So he's a scholar within Hanafi. But he isn't in another one. Okay, but he's at least, you could say he's a scholar of that. So you have to master the fiqh. And you have to understand, you know, not only how the jurisprudence is set up, what are all the means of setting it up, but the practical applications of it. And that is where the fatwas are there. That's how making religious decisions are there. Okay? Then one of the important subjects, some say it's even maybe the critical subject right in the beginning to understand, you need to understand aqidah. You need to understand theology. And so the scholar's got to be grounded in the tenets of Islamic faith, which means your belief in Allah, the angels, the prophets, the books, the afterlife, the qadr, right? You have to go over the texts. You have to understand the belief system. And even deeply into books like At-Tahawiyah, the Aqidah of At-Tahawi, which is a famous one, and the theological debates. You'd have to be able to handle yourself and understand debates when people are going astray. Why? Because there's deviations. Deviations have come in Islam. People have come in Islam claiming all types of things, claiming that they're prophets. They claim all types of strange things. And if you're not grounded in aqidah, you can't tell when somebody is coming with a deviation. So that's crucial for a scholar to understand their faith. It is a critical point. You know, right after the revelation, you've got to know these beliefs. Okay? You also need to know, and again, it's a big subject, and I'm giving you a few of the basic aspects of being an alim, but there are more. I would say it's important also Islamic history and context, which means seerah. You've got to know the life of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, how it was applied. And to be a real scholar, you need to be aware of historical development of Islamic thought, right? That's today, right? And some of the great scholars you're going to see, Imam Abu Hanifa, Imam al-Ghazali, Imam Ibn Taymiyyah, and somebody say, well, what about Ghazali? Because I heard that part of his life he was only a spiritual person. But usul al-fiqh, remember fiqh, and you have the methodology of fiqh called usul. The strongest book in usul al-Mustasqa, that was written by Imam al-Ghazali. So he was a scholar also in Islamic jurisprudence. Okay? So now, the scholar, the true scholar, because we're looking at this thing in a positive way in the beginning, the true scholar needs to have taqwa, fear of Allah, consciousness of Allah, right? So that they can actually implement it, they can guard against arrogance and hypocrisy and all the evil qualities, right, to uphold truth and justice, regardless of the consequences. That is your real scholar. Sincerity, ikhlas. The true scholar has to be sincere. Okay? And, you know, when that person is doing it for Allah and not for money. Because the problem today is you have what is called ulama sultan. They are the scholars of the king. That the king will give them a package. Give them some money. Buy them. Bribery. To bribe them. Right? Doesn't work. Number three, humility, tawadu. And that means that the scholar has to recognize that he doesn't know everything. And the basis of knowledge, according to many of the great scholars, is that when you can say, I don't know. When you say, I don't know, now you've entered into scholarship. And you have to have character, because you have to be a model of what you are teaching. And it is said that the students of Imam Malik, especially, they're quoted to have said, that two-thirds of what we learned from Imam Malik was not book knowledge. It was his adab. It was his character. That's what we learned. Because he was implementing Islam. Okay? So that is what the true scholar will be. What does a scholar have to do? And again, this information, inshallah, will be made available to you at the end. If you got a flash drive, I'm going to give you this PowerPoint. You can have this information. It'll be made available to you. And what are the roles and responsibilities? Okay, the scholar has got to... Now, here's where you see the value of the scholar. The scholar has to teach and to guide, transmit the knowledge, right? And guide people into the knowledge of Quran, Hadith, Fiqh, right? And help the people into this and have that spiritual base, right? Have that the ethics that is needed. Next, fatwas. The scholars will have to issue legal rulings. They will have to be up to date with what is happening. Research, be aware of the usage of terminologies. Right? They'll have to be able to do that in order to be up to date. I remember that when I was in Medina, I got a message from the brothers and sisters in California. And they said there's a new, there's this drug that's out here. They call it angel's dust. And angel's dust, they used to take embalmer's fluid. You know, the fluid you put in dead bodies, right, to preserve it, right? So in California, they would take that and they would snort it up their nose. And they would go crazy. And they would run around all night. And the next day, he's laying in a hospital and they say, what happened to you? And he says, I don't know, but I had a good time. They sent me a letter and they said, go to the sheikh and ask him what angel's dust. So I said, okay, I got to translate this in Arabic, right? Because he was Egyptian. So I said, okay, your sheikh, Turab al-Malaika. It's angel's dust. He said, angel's dust? Let me have some. Yeah. Right? I said, okay, now I'm going to tell you what it is. Then I explained what it was. And he said, la, this is khamar. This is an intoxicant. And it's haram. So the scholars have to be up to date. You understand? Be able to give legal rulings when it comes. Next, the true scholar, and we're starting in a positive light, what it really is. This is what President Erdogan needs. This is what the other kings and rulers in the Muslim world need. Right? They have to defend the faith. They have to stand up and deal with the misconceptions when they come in. Deviant undercurrents. They have to be able to protect the Muslim world. The scholar also, the true scholar needs to be balanced. You got to balance the dunya and akhirah. You don't go one extreme or another, but you can actually balance things, right? And you can take a strong position that's relevant to the world. And we'll be studying Imam Ahmed ibn Hanbal, Imam Ibn Taymiyyah and others, and the stance they took, what happened in their times, and the stances that they took in terms of defending Islam. Next, the scholar needs to be involved in da'wah, calling to Islam, providing a positive image of the faith. And scholarship, the true scholar, it's a lifetime study. It doesn't end when you graduate from a university. Okay, it's continuous research, continuous study that goes on, exploring and asking what is happening and engaging with contemporary issues. The real scholars were up to date with what was happening during their times. And we're going to study Islamic history to look at the times and what they actually did, how the scholars, how their scholarship actually changed the events or instituted major changes within the societies. Okay? So C, critical thinking, and there's a thing called ijtihad, right, which is independent reasoning to be able to make decisions in contemporary issues. Okay? These are some of the areas that the scholar needs to be involved in. So in conclusion, and there's a statement here, again, you'll have this made available to you, inshallah, that the true scholar is not merely one with vast knowledge, but someone who embodies that knowledge through ethical conduct, spiritual sincerity, and commitment to guiding the community. Okay? They're in a pivotal role in preserving Islamic tradition. Okay? The true scholar is a beacon of wisdom, justice, and truth in a complex world. Now, somebody asked Imam Shafi how a person could become a scholar, and he replied, "My brother, it is possible to attain knowledge only if you fulfill six conditions: intelligence, passion, perseverance, sustenance, guidance of a teacher, and many years of dedicated studies to reach this point." And somebody might say, well, wow, this is almost impossible. They're like, ain't they, when Islam is healthy and our schools are there and we don't put our wealth and time in secular studies, you will have a lot of scholars. You will have scholars on a high, high level. Very possible. We still have millions, alhamdulillah, that have memorized the whole Quran or, you know, much of it. We can take it a step further and have scholarship. But this is the basis. We need to understand what is a scholar and then to understand the relationship with the rulers. Because the rulers for us are clear. They are the ones with the temporal, with the gun, with the sword, the sultan, the president, the political power. Okay? And what is going to be their relationship? That will be our study, inshallah. And from next week, we will start to go into some practical Islamic history to look at how this relationship developed from early times, coming up into the times that we are living today. So I want to open up the floor for any questions that anybody may have. This is the basis. This is the basis. What is a scholar in Islam? These are the ulama. So the floor is open for any questions that anybody may have. Anybody online who has any questions concerning anything?
This criteria entails that one would have to spend decades to become a scholar and possibly be of older age. Are there examples of young scholars in history?
Yes, you will see that many of the scholars, like, you know, the great Imam An-Nawawi, you know, you'll read about him and, you know, Riyad al-Salihin and the 40 Hadith, he's a great scholar. He passed away around 40 years old. That's when he died. So they actually start, the real scholarship starts when it is a child age. Memorization of the Quran, many scholars memorized the whole Quran before they were even 9 or 10 years old. So it starts when you're young. Sheikh Uthman Danfodi, rahimahullah, that we've spoken about before, you know, of the Sokoto Caliphate, you know, in West Africa. His father was a scholar. His mother was a scholar. His uncle, he grew up in a house of scholarship. He learned the Quran from when he was young. Sidi Ahmed Zarruq, you know, from when they were young. You'll see the scholars, it starts when you're very young and your brain is really wide open. And when you memorize the Quran, you'll be shocked to see. You know, they say that we only use a small percentage of our brains. Some say maybe even 10% or 15%. There's a lot in our brain. And there's things called telepathy, and there's things that you can do with your mind. When you memorize the Quran, when you memorize poetry, it opens up your mind. So scholars develop, like this Sheikh from Mauritania, and the Mauritanians are famous for this. It's like a photogenic memory. They will read something, and it's there in their head. It's like carrying a flash drive around. But the flash drive's your head. Like AI, your brain is an AI that we now go to. So literally, when you start young, and that's what Islamic society will do, you don't have to wait until you're 50, 60 years old to be a scholar. You'll actually see that Sheikh Uthman Danfodio, by the time he was 20 years old, he had mastered Maliki fiqh. He went into the field at 20. Okay, so it's very possible at a younger age the person can go into the field. Okay, and again, it's about, you know, it's not that you master, nobody can master everything, by the way. Nobody. But you'll have a sufficient amount that you'll be able to understand or you can research. And remember about saying, I don't know. In one case, Imam Malik, rahimahullah, was asked 50 questions, and in about 44 of them or so, he said, La adri, I don't know the answer. And that's Imam Malik, where the first book of hadith, Al-Muwatta. Okay, so this is Imam Malik. He said, I don't know, like he's going to research it. So the scholar isn't somebody that knows every single thing in their mind. You can't know everything. But you have access to the information. You'll have a good portion, and you'll have access to it. You reach a certain level where you could say that person is a scholar. Okay? But you don't know everything. Question.
Can you give us some history of the scholars that became Mujahideen?
Yes. So inshallah, this is the basis of our class. We will be going on, and next week we will be looking at practical applications of this. We're in a funny period now because of Salat al-Maghrib and Isha, so we had to sort of break, but next week we're getting closer to where we'll have a straight, longer period of time for the class. This is orientating us to it. But next week we'll be going into practical applications. You'll see scholarship in action, where it actually affected the society, and you'll see some of the changes and the things that actually had when you know the people had this. And what we're looking for, again, is not just scholarship for scholarship. It's the relationship with the rulers. What's the relationship with the ruler? Because that's our problem today. Our rulers are now destroying our countries for the most part. Muslims want to move in Palestine and other places. But their leaders holding them down. As the Prophet said, he feared these leaders even more than Dajjal. Part of the problem is the ulama. If the ulama are not checking the scholars, that are the rulers, then the evil ruler can persist. Question? Yeah, go ahead.
When you're talking about the practical application of the history, like comparing it to today's time as well, the things that we can do in our like daily life to, because we only have so much power too, because we're not on the levels of ulama and scholars and that,
right.
What can we do in our daily life to get set things right?
Yes, well, I mean, you know, what can we do in our daily life to get things right? Number one, we need to study. We need to try to get as much understanding of Islam as possible. Understand the Quran, understand the traditions, you know, be involved in this as much as you can, because the more you study and the more you get familiar to the revelation, then you can start to see light and darkness. So that's one of the things that we can do. And then apply our knowledge, because this is one of the key things. Application of knowledge. That is critical. So we can begin by getting involved. And understand, everybody doesn't have to be the highest level of scholar. But the more we understand about the deen, then the more we can understand deviation and where things go wrong. And inshallah, next week, we will be starting to go into some practical applications where you're going to actually see relationships of rulers and scholars, because we want to know what is happening, you know, so that we can apply for the future, inshallah, in the next generation, or even help to correct what is going on in the Muslim world today.
So, yeah. Turkey, right? They actually manufacturing their own jet fighters.
Right. So
they're actually test run it already.
Right. The Turks they have their own fighters. They have their own automobile car.
Yeah.
They have some of the best drones in the world.
Yeah.
Like their drones, they give it out to other people.
So that's the reason why I said, you know, it's speech we sell.
Right. Plus they have a military.
Yeah.
And they have thousands of soldiers.
Yeah.
And the Turks still have a fighting spirit.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, something's got to happen where all that potential now can be used to establish justice, right? And that me and right now, the biggest problem is on the top.
Yeah.
Something holding it down.
Yeah.
And that has got to change.
Inshallah.
Inshallah. Question?
In our modern culture, we utilize PhDs, books, and writing articles to refer to scholars. Did Islam scholars have similar systems?
Yeah, so when we say PhDs and writing books, no, this is a different system than the Western system. But there is, again, you saw these subjects, there is what is called ijazah. The ijazah system is when you take a subject and the teacher gives you the right, they feel that you have now mastered the subject and you can teach it. So they give you ijazah. Okay, and so when you get that ijazah in different subjects, you know, then this is the basis of the Western society. Because actually it was the Muslims who introduced the university system to Europe. That was in Toledo and then in Granada. And even, you know, one time, you know, there was a discussion about the word baccalaureate. You know, BA? What does baccalaureate mean? It's a Latin word. Most people don't know, right? But it's interesting because in North Africa and in Andalus, you know, there was a time the ijazah said bihaqq al-riwaya. Bihaqq al-riwaya means you have the right to teach this subject. So if you look at it, bihaqq al-riwaya, baccalaureate. You see it? And they would you would put on an abaya, right? And then you'd put on, you know, either a scarf or you have a turban. Now what they do? The black thing, but they smashed the turban down, right? And you have they copied us. They literally copied us in our whole system. Okay? But the difference was that the scholars, the balanced scholars in the height of Islam, not only did they study fiqh and Quran, they also studied math. So you would go from your hadith class and you go chemistry. So you see that many of the scholars, they were balanced. So it's the balanced curriculum. And that also has to be reintroduced to the Muslim world. This is our future. We can't have just scholars who memorize the Quran, they can do nothing else but just read. And they don't even know what they're reading. We have to go past this. And it's got to be now scholars who understand what they're reading and then implement it. You see, when that happens, then we go somewhere. And it's not that difficult, especially when a society on the top, the wealth of the society, supports the scholars. It's just like what's happening in the West. When the Western countries, when America and Canada or Europe, they had the wealth, then they had scholars, they give you a scholarship to come. How many scholars in America now, in Canada, come from outside of America? Go to Silicon Valley. And you see most of them come from India, Pakistan, or from Egypt. Go to Cape Canaveral, the Egyptians. Go to the doctors in Texas and other places. You'll see that Muslims are there. Other people, other nations are there because they have the money. And they'll take care of you. So when Muslims did that, we had the golden age of Islam. It's the same phenomenon. And that can happen again.
Right now we still have that. put into nuclear facility in Darlington. The guy retired, he's Egyptian. They can't find nobody, right? You retired like 6 years now, right?
That's right.
And they'll need him back, and he's running the project, right?
That's right, and he's Egyptian.
Yeah.
And that is right here in Toronto.
Yeah.
The head of the nuclear thing is Egyptian.
Yeah. Is it actually Dr. Hindi?
Right.
They asked him to go back.
Ibrahim Hindi. I mean, his father, yeah.
Yeah, because he asked me, I said, I retired, brother, that's it.
Right.
What did they ask him to do, Ibrahim Hindi?
Huh?
What did they ask him to do?
His father, actually, Ali Hindi.
Oh. It's
his father.
He's a nuclear engineer, right? So they put in two new reactors, Darlington, and they don't have nobody to run the project.
So to run the project in Darlington right here, they're calling back an Egyptian. He's a fiery practicing Muslim too, right? Go to his khutbah now, right? Some of them say, no, we don't want this man around a nuclear reactor, right? But the point is, he combines both, right? That's what we're talking about.
That's still common in universities now too. So when people are taking more like advanced or technical degrees, like anything like technology, medicine, whatever, they're still required, especially in the early years, to take more social degrees as well, because they teach them, like, when you get into this mindset of just I'm learning math and physics and science, then you start forgetting about the social aspect, which is a very important part of just living with humans, right?
That's right.
But I feel that too, like within Muslims we don't have that balance, we're always just on two extremes,
right? So this is now again the balanced scholars, and we will see this. That's what we want to look at. And next week, inshallah, we're going to go to the ultimate balanced scholars, the most balanced scholars in Islamic history. You will be seeing next week, inshallah, for our class. Okay? So with that, we will close the class, and inshallah, we'll see you again next week. And we're going to take another step into the practical world of the relationship of minarets to thrones, to the scholars, to the rulers. I leave you with these thoughts, and I ask Allah to have mercy on me and you. وآخر دعوانا الحمد لله رب العالمين والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته